This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Louis Agassiz was one of the founding fathers of the Woods Hole scientific community. One of his most famous quotes, "Study nature, not books," hangs on the wall of the MBL Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution Science Library. That simple quote epitomizes much about the man who said it, a man with boundless curiosity and childlike enthusiasm, whose prolific work and highly publicized views have always inspired passionate followers and also passionate critics. Agassiz was a complex man, a man of public science and private religion, a prolific comparative zoologist and popularizer of the idea of ice ages, but also a staunch opponent of Charles Darwin's theory of evolution. He was an abolitionist, but also an incorrigible racist. Professor Christoph Irmscher of Indiana University explores Agassiz's complicated life and legacy in a new biography. It's entitled Louis Agassiz, Creator of American Science. And Christoph Irmscher joins me now in our Woods Hole studio. Christoph Irmscher, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Heather.
Now, the last biography of Agassiz, at least that I could find, was written over 50 years ago. Why attempt a new account of Agassiz's life now?
Edward Lurie's biography of Agassiz focuses on Agassiz's scientific life, on the contributions to science that he made. I was more interested in putting him back in his cultural context. I'm a literature scholar by training, and I was fascinated by the fact that whoever you look at, Emerson, Longfellow, all the New England Brahmin, the important cultural and literary people admired him. His name shows up wherever you look. It shows up in journals. It shows up in reports about meetings, about dinners, and so forth. Agassiz epitomized for many New Englanders European sophistication. He was somebody that they wanted to be associated with. They also appreciated his science. There was a connection with transcendentalism. Agassiz believed that if you just keep working hard enough at your science, you can get as close to the mind of God as anyone can, because the divinity resides in you. It's untapped potential inside you. That idea was something that was very, very attractive to many New Englanders. And coming from the study of the 19th century, coming from the study of Longfellow, I wrote a biography of Longfellow, it seemed sort of a natural step to want to find out more about Agassiz and to put him back into that cultural landscape.
Now, you actually start the book with his death, and obviously starting at the end and flashing back to the beginning is not an uncommon literary technique, but no. It is a choice. Why start with his death?
It came out of a certain dissatisfaction with a kind of cradle-to-grave biography. I just wanted to start with a flourish, I guess. But one of the things that it allowed me to do is to begin the book by emphasizing how important he was, because Agassiz's dying was a very public affair. People participated in it. There were bulletins posted about Agassiz's health, how it was deteriorating. And when he died, it was front page news in the New York Times. And in his autopsy, actually, was published. The results of his autopsy were published. And I wanted to give the reader a measure of his importance, that a scientist's death is front page news. And that to me became sort of a metaphor, I guess, for Agassiz's importance, not just to the scientific community, but to everyone in the United States. And that's how Agassiz would have wanted it.
Yeah, I mean, you note that the newspapers the day after his death were actually published with a black border around them.
Yeah.
Flags flew at half mast around Harvard on the day of his funeral.
Yes.
Is there any other American scientist since Agassiz that has reached this level of popular celebrity?
I don't know that there would have been one. But then Agassiz was unique in the sense that he felt that his science was a public affair, that this is something that everyone should participate in. Everyone had a stake in it the way he wanted it. Ordinary people helped collect specimens for him. People would write him letters, would share scientific discoveries with him, hoping that he would write back. They would deliver specimens right to his doorstep. So all of that is a measure of his importance.
You also highlight in the nature of his death, which was essentially that he had a massive stroke. But you highlight that he had ongoing health problems, some sort of neurological problems for years, and that was kind of part of his public persona, this dichotomy between being an incredibly vital person, very active, one of the hardest working people in science at that time, and yet at the same time, this fragility of his health, and that he actually played that up publicly. He was not just he was really crafting his own public persona as he went.
Yes, he was a celebrity, and he wanted to be a celebrity, and he's part of that emerging celebrity culture in the 19th century that we see kind of in a way shaping the way we think about people in the 20th century. He was very clever when it came to crafting news releases about himself. The whole thing about his health, he was a big man. He towered over people. He was physically very strong, and this reputation preceded him. When he was a mountaineer, he was somebody who was an experienced hiker. There were illustrations published of Agassiz having himself lowered into glaciers because he wanted to measure them. So this kind of physical courage, his fitness was something that preceded him. But of course, he wanted people also to know that he was working hard, that he that every fiber of his being was invested in his work, and that therefore they should respect him. That was a way of underlining his importance. No, I'm not saying that he didn't have medical problems, but it was something that really became part and parcel of his celebrity status. People had to worry about him. People had to take part in his the sacrifice that he was making for this country. And in a way, there's a great contrast between him and Darwin. Darwin had suffered from ill health most of his professional life after he returned from the voyage of the Beagle. But for Darwin, there was a reason to stay out of the limelight, to let other people do the work for him. For Agassiz, it was just the opposite. You know, he brought himself in publicly, and people would appreciate that despite his hard work, despite his failing health, he was someone who would still make himself available to everybody.
All right, we'll talk more about Agassiz and Darwin in a little bit. Let's actually go back to the beginning. Agassiz's celebrity is really as an American scientist, but of course he was Swiss-born. So talk a little bit about his early life. His father was a minister. What do we know about his family and his early life?
We do know quite a bit about his family. We have letters that his father wrote to him, in which his father actually for quite some time tried to discourage him from being a scientist because he felt it was not appropriate. He was supposed to be a doctor, or actually a businessman, first of all, and that failed. A medical doctor was acceptable to his father. It was a rather limited environment in some ways intellectually. These were, in a sense, people who'd grown up in the mountains, being overshadowed by the mountains. And to some extent, the mountains were in Agassiz's blood as well. There was something of the peasant in him in some ways, you know, somebody who came from a rather limited environment and then expanded and really became a self-made man. He studied at some of the best universities that Europe had to offer. He went to Heidelberg. He went to Munich. He did become a doctor, but at the same time, he also got a doctorate in natural history. And so while his father was satisfied, at the same time, Agassiz made it very clear that he had no intention of following a medical career or settling down in Switzerland as a country doctor, which would have been acceptable to his family. He rejected his religious background, replacing his father's rather narrow Protestantism with a sort of all-inclusive universal religion. He found the Unitarian principles of his friends quite attractive. But at the same time, never, and his American friends pointed that out, he never went to church on Sundays. So he was not somebody who would be roped into any kind of Orthodox kind of religious context. And his father was a thing of the past. At the same time, one of the things that I found looking at his father's letters, which are very controlling, you know, he's trying to shape his son's life. When we look at what Agassiz later on did with his assistants, same thing, you know, the same kind of authoritarianism, the same kind of doctrinaire stubbornness that his father displays. So his environment follows him around in a way.
He's got the like father, like son, whether or not he likes it or not.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, you mentioned that he had both essentially a PhD, a doctor of philosophy, and the MD. I mean,
yeah.
We have programs now that bestow MD PhDs. Was that a common thing, or is that one more manifestation of his energy and ambition.
For many scientists in the 19th century, getting a medical education was, in fact, the way to acquire some solid scientific training. And his great antagonist at Harvard, Asa Gray, also had a medical doctorate. It was not from a school that was nearly as distinguished as where Agassiz had gone, but that in and of itself was not unusual. Even later, his favorite student, William James, got a doctorate in medicine, even though he had to promise, apparently, Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., that he would never lay his hands on a patient. And, you know, James became a psychologist, which is, of course, an easy connection to make. But so, in a way, that was not unusual. What was unusual is that Agassiz pursued both careers simultaneously and did them so vigorously. And his dissertation, in fact, a book about Brazilian fish, which he'd completed under the supervision of one of his teachers, became, you know, just this absolutely beautiful, beautifully illustrated publication, still written in Latin, but with absolutely amazing illustration that kind of set, in a way, or blazed the trail for his future works, which were always these kind of gloriously illustrated books. And so from the beginning, we see this determination not to be limited by what his family had tried to impose on him.
Now, as you mentioned, he went to some of the most prestigious schools. He studied with Georges Cuvier and Alexander von Humboldt, some of the most prominent scientists of the day. Talk a little bit about his relationship in particular with von Humboldt.
Humboldt was an interesting man, somebody who, despite his fame, would still invest much in personal relationships. And we see that in his letters to Agassiz. He adopted Agassiz when they became friends in Paris. Agassiz had always wanted to have a relationship with Humboldt. He wanted to go on an expedition that Humboldt was organizing, and that didn't work out. So he was delighted when he was able to make the connection in Paris. And Humboldt, from being a kind of mentor, very quickly became a sort of father figure, or somebody who was even a friend in some ways. The letters are marked by Humboldt's letters to Agassiz are marked by a great deal of affection. Sometimes he is playful, even. He chides Agassiz for being so interested in ice, and Agassiz's developing interest when he settled down in Switzerland as a scientist at first was, in fact, in glaciers. And Humboldt would say, you know, why do you want to put that skull cap of ice on the world? Your glaciers make me shudder. They make me afraid. Humboldt was a man who loved warm climates. You know, South America was his area. And there's this playful kind of banter going on. At the same time, Humboldt is always pushing him to better himself, to set goals for himself, to keep working. He lends him money. It's just an incredible relationship. And to some degree, Humboldt did something for Agassiz that Agassiz later on was not able to do with his own mentees, with his own students. When Agassiz is in trouble financially, personally, and wants to go to the United States, Humboldt helps him get the money for that. And he supports him. He lets him go, basically. He's not saying, you've got to stay here, you've got to stay with me, you've got to stay within the sphere of my influence. Go, do something with yourself that you can't do over here, which to me has always seemed to be rather remarkable.
I mean, there's an element of a rags-to-riches story here, that you yes. take this boy from a rural minister's family. He gets the best education. He kind of adopts a new father figure that's the opposite, possibly, of his own father, and then ends up jumping a whole continent and spending his whole yes. life trying to be the ultimate celebrity. I mean, is all of this throughout his life driven by some desire to escape his father originally?
Some of it is a desire to escape from his environment. I would say what's more important is, and this is why he's such a complicated figure, what's more important is his passion for finding things out, which did communicate itself to people around him. He was somebody who would never tire of discovering new things. There's a story that he liked to tell, that once when he, because he had spent so much time looking at things, he couldn't, his eyes gave out, and he would take a fossil and just taste it, because that was the sense that was still available to him at that point. And that kind of enthusiasm for natural things is genuine in Agassiz's case. It's paired with a lot of other things that are maybe not so attractive and not so genuine, but there's certainly the notion that you need to find out everything you can about what's around you, which is why he was not satisfied with the environment into which he was born. He wanted more. He wanted to see more. And it was something that was driving him, which was certainly not had not happened to his father or others in his family.
I'm talking with Christoph Ermscher about his biography of Louis Agassiz, one of the founding fathers of science in Woods Hole and beyond. The book is Louis Agassiz, Creator of American Science. We'll talk more about Agassiz's accomplishments after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest this hour is Christoph Ermscher, professor of English at Indiana University and author of Louis Agassiz, Creator of American Science. Now, as we were talking about before the break, Louis Agassiz performed this kind of feat of recreating himself. And part of that was his move to America. And you were talking a little bit about how his mentor, Humboldt, actually enabled him to make that leap across the sea. What was the impetus for that move, and why did he actually stay?
The impetus for this move was, first of all, an institutional one. Agassiz was, in fact, at a fairly undistinguished school. He was not a center of learning. He was in Neuchâtel in Switzerland. It was an academy that he was at, but it was not something that was really in many ways suitable for his energies. He transformed the school he was at, but it was not something that he found quite limiting in some ways. He'd started his own printing press. He engaged in many kind of ventures, and he spent too much money, basically. So technically, he was broke. He was at a point financially where there's no way forward. He'd been spending more and more time in the mountains in a little cabin that he built out of rocks with his assistants. He was not spending time at home. And rather remarkably, his wife, Cecile, left him because she just couldn't stand the kind of life that she had with him anymore. Rather remarkable move for a 19th century woman. She was a beautiful painter, very, very interesting figure who really hasn't played much of a role in previous biographies. But she just packs her stuff and moves out. And even her brother, who was Agassiz's college classmate, told her not to do it, told her to stick it out. And Cecile just wouldn't have any of it. And she left. So Agassiz was, in fact, alone. He was broke. And there was really no way forward where he was. And in that situation, the invitation to give lectures in Boston was a godsend, and he found the new world just so fascinating. People appreciated him that staying became almost a natural thing for him.
Now, you mentioned his first wife, who he then moves to America and he remarries, which, if the first part of the story weren't remarkable enough for that day and age, for him to then remarry in America.
Yes. His first wife died. He had, in fact, made the move to America. He had accepted an appointment as professor of natural history at Harvard University. And he met Elizabeth Carey, who was really instrumental to Agassiz's career in ways that he couldn't have anticipated when he met Elizabeth Carey of Temple Place. She was in Boston from a remarkable, remarkable family with many, many connections. She was not formally trained, but she had a very sharp mind, and she was also a good writer. And that became essential to Agassiz's success, because Elizabeth Agassiz took over the writing of his books. She would sit in on his lectures. She would transcribe them. She would go every single line that he'd written and would essentially shape them for publication. So the kind of popularity that he gained through his writing, articles in the Atlantic Monthly, books on how to study natural history, in no small part was due to his wife's influence.
And she essentially, at the end of his life, kind of became his first biographer. I mean, there were,
yes,
as you mentioned, a lot of different people who were, he was friends with many writers, and there were a lot of different people trying to contribute their own versions of his life and of his death. But she, of course, was the closest.
She condensed his letters, other writings, into a two-volume biography, which she took very seriously. She was writing this at the time when Agassiz's reputation was already overshadowed, many of by the fact that so many of his former students, including his own son, had accepted Darwinism as the working hypothesis of their scientific lives. And you see how smart Elizabeth is when you look at how she's really sanitizing to some extent his legacy. She's leaving out passages in the letters that might seem problematic. She's combining them into a narrative that really focuses on exactly the story that you mentioned earlier, the how this man reinvents himself in an almost Franklinesque way, you know, from rags to riches. And it's a compelling story. It's not her best book. She did her own writing. She published two books, natural history books, in which she's kind of freer to write the way she wants to. She's really constrained by preserving his legacy. So it's the last kind of service she could do for him.
Now, your biography is titled Louis Agassiz, Creator of American Science. Why do you think he deserves that title, Creator of American Science?
Because he thought of science as part of the fabric of society in a way no one else had done before. Of course, there were scientists in America at the time, scientists who had done a great deal establishing, you know, credible institutions of learning. Agassiz comes in and really thinks of science as a collective enterprise, as something that needs to be funded by society. The scientist, in return for the money, works as hard as he can. So Agassiz puts science on the cultural map like no one else had done before, creating the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard, which is really was a significant accomplishment. Of course, there were many problems. The museum was always too full and sometimes couldn't serve the public the way it was supposed to be. But just thinking of this institution as something that would be available to the public, hiring assistants, he hired actually female assistants to work in the museum. So he had a dedication also to bringing women into science. All of that is kind of new, as is the laboratory that he creates at the museum, which in for all intents and purposes is one of the first graduate schools in science in the United States. You know, students came from all over the United States and from abroad to work with him in this laboratory, which was very innovative in terms of methods, not in terms of the theories that Agassiz would expose them to. And many students picked up on that, but in terms of the kind of form of interaction that he created there. It's definitely sort of an innovative foundational gesture, as I would describe it.
I mean, in some ways, what you're describing is crowdsourcing science, citizen science, things that are really hot now, and we're talking about this happening in the mid to late 1800s.
Exactly. Yeah.
He was a century or more ahead of his time.
Yeah, yeah.
So talk a little bit more about, I mean, he called the Museum of Comparative Zoology, which he founded, you say his museum. Mm-hmm. It really was. I mean, it was essentially his collection, and it was his baby, and he was there every day. An intense dedication to this collection.
Yes, and one of the kind of tragic parts of that is that Agassiz just didn't know how to stop. It was not just his collection. He was getting collections from other people. He was swapping specimens. He was sending out people to collect more and more and more. And he was essentially forgetting that in order to make this truly a public institution, you have to select, you have to condense. He had this notion that he could get the whole of nature inside the walls of the museum. The museum was constantly expanding. His assistants were overworked. They were complaining. Agassiz, in one rare moment of introspection, says, "My museum overflows from garret to cellar. He doesn't know what to do with things anymore. Alcohol is leaking out of the barrels. It stinks." And so in a nutshell, that's Agassiz's persona as well. This is a man who, when he came to the United States, was working in so many different disciplines, now considered separate, whether it was paleontology, marine biology, anatomy, geology, and so forth. He just thought he could do it all. And this was at a time when people were beginning to realize that this is not how you do science anymore, that this comprehensiveness leads to, in many ways, to amateurism, and that's something that was not available to Agassiz. So this museum, in a way, is a metaphor that for what was happening in a science in other ways.
Now, of course, here on Cape Cod, one of Agassiz's great legacies is that he founded what later would be in a different incarnation called the Penikese Island School, but the Anderson School of Natural History on Penikese Island, which was, again, very groundbreaking, as you say, incorporating women, really focusing on teaching science to teachers. And this was one of his last accomplishments of life.
Yeah, it was during his last year of his life. And again, this was a project that very nearly could have gone wrong, because when people came to the island, he invited more than a dozen women, actually, and others to come and spend time with him studying nature in the act. This was one of his favorite phrases, you know, that you actually go out into the field and that you work in the field. Agassiz was known for plunging into the water, holding a microscope, for example, because he wanted to be so close to the specimens. And he wanted to make this available to other people as well. And when people arrived on Penikese Island, the buildings weren't even done yet. People were still working on it. So nothing really was in place. There's a great short story by Andrea Barrett called The Island, which kind of describes what is happening from the perspective of one of those female school teachers that he'd invited, and how she becomes kind of disenchanted with it, which gives you a great glimpse of how innovative this was, but at the same time, how focused it was on Agassiz's personality, because everything depended on him. He was there every day. He lectured, and disagreeing with the science became a matter of criticizing him personally, which is something that he didn't take lightly.
And this school was not just for women. It was,
no.
He invited a mixture of men and women. It was co-education.
Women, yes. It's a co-educational school.
And the dorms weren't even done yet.
Yes.
I mean, you're already doing something that's a little edgy.
Exactly.
And then...
Yeah. Yeah. But again, this is something that would happen to him all over his life, because that's how his mind worked. It sort of leaped ahead of the facts wherever he went. And some people think that this is what eventually killed him, you know, this kind of discrepancy between his ambitions and what he could actually accomplish. One other part of this is, you know, his scientific work was actually lagging behind his work as an organizer, as an institution builder. He was not producing the kind of quality work anymore that he'd done when he was in Europe, because he was so invested in all these kind of organizational things.
And yet, in terms of quantity, he was amazingly productive. 400 papers and books in his lifetime.
But his masterwork, what he wanted to be his legacy, contributions to the study of the natural history of the United States of America, was supposed to be a 10-volume work covering all aspects of natural history. And he only finished 4 volumes, Jellyfish and Turtles, basically. And even those volumes were done with the significant help of his assistants, one of whom, Henry James Clark, later on publicly complained and said, "My work's been stolen. You've plagiarized what I did. You're passing it off as your own work." Agassiz had come to depend on his network of helpers, on his assistants, in order to produce his science. And while, again, this is sort of a modern aspect in some ways of Agassiz's work, you know, that science is a collective enterprise, it also reflects the other side of Agassiz, because he felt that while many people had helped him, the product was his name. The product bore his name. It had to be his trademark, basically, and he would not allow others into sharing it, just as his wife's contributions were not officially announced on the title page as written by Elizabeth Agassiz or something like that. That was certainly not the case. Always Louis Agassiz.
Is there any documentation or any evidence that as his life progressed, as he essentially got further and further behind, the disparity between his goals and his what he was able to accomplish is getting larger, that was a source of stress to him? Or did he not even really allow himself to see that? Was it just all enthusiasm?
Well, you see it from letters that are written very hastily. You know, his letters become frantic in some ways. There's notes, even some notes that I collected from my own collection, where he says, "Oh, I'm not sure if I can do this, but you'll have it, I promise," and so forth. So he's always rushed. He's always under pressure. There's never a moment of relaxation for him. And you get a sense that this was a man who never confronted his own demons. Introspection is something that was not available to him. This is not a guy who sits down and keeps a journal at night, reflecting on how his life is developing. He doesn't have time for that, and he doesn't allow himself those moments. So he was, in many ways, oblivious to things that were happening around him. His students at Harvard at one point founded a society for the protection against foreign professors, which was, you know, meant against Agassiz. And he was very surprised and personally disappointed that his paternal kind of love for these students would be rewarded by such hostility, and couldn't figure out how this could have happened to him.
Now, you mentioned that lack of introspection and how rushed he was. One challenge in writing a biography is that there aren't many source documents that come from him. You have to rely on what everyone else around him is writing about him. So how do you, as a historian and a biographer, how do you begin to reconcile all of these different secondhand accounts with no primary account to go on?
It is a difficult thing to do. In Edward Lurie's case, the previous biography, he made a decision to focus on his scientific accomplishments and take us through his life, you know, following those accomplishments and how they develop, and also pointing out the problems. In my case, I decided to allow other people into my narrative, which is a risky thing to do, but I felt it was necessary for us, you know, in order for us to get a fuller picture of who he was. So I have a chapter where I essentially adopt the perspective of one of his favorite students, who then turns out to be a great kind of problem for Agassiz. And Agassiz, they separate ways. I devote two chapters basically to his wife, who was the person who knew him best. And so getting these observers, these people who in a way speak for Agassiz and often against Agassiz, getting them into my book was very important to me. And while this meant I was taking risks a little bit in terms of, you know, not having Agassiz always center stage in his own words, I felt that the gain was more important. Getting this kind of complete picture. And there were some texts that I found as I was, you know, working through the archives, where we get a bit more of a glimpse of him. There's an unpublished note that he writes about Assam, a verse where he kind of reveals how important it is for him to do science. But these notes were few and far between. So I had to sort of strike a compromise between using his letters and using the letters of other people, using the accounts of other people in which he appears.
Now, you write that his wife was essentially taken in by the public persona that he tries to put out there. And she becomes, in her writing about him, somewhat of a perpetuator of that. Can you see her begin to adopt that, to lose perhaps her grip on the real situation as you look through what she's written or what we still have of her account of life with Agassiz?
I can see both things. I can see her defending her husband, shoring up again her view of him against hostility from the outside, and it's definitely the case in her biography. But I can also see moments where she kind of not disagrees with him, but adopts a slightly different perspective. For me, one of the most luminous moments of that kind happened when they went to the Galapagos late in Agassiz's life, and where Agassiz just completely entrenched in his opposition to Darwin. And Elizabeth Agassiz is, as we can tell from her letter, she's reading Voyage of the Beagle. She's looking around. She's remembering that Darwin went there before. And while Agassiz is telling his students, you know, there's absolutely no way that Darwin can be right. These islands are of recent geological origin. The kind of changes that Darwin is interested in take a long time, so essentially it's all nonsense. And Elizabeth Agassiz says at one point, why don't we just spend more time looking at things? Why do we always have to rush? Maybe something can be found here if we look very carefully that might in fact help us adopt a different perspective. Now, she's not saying a Darwinist perspective, and she's not saying there will be proof if we just look carefully enough, but she's at least saying that Agassiz's approach is problematic. And we see later on in her career when she, after Agassiz's death, when she becomes president of Radcliffe, that she has a very different approach to dealing with her students. She's not somebody who pushes herself into the foreground. In fact, in the memories of Radcliffe students collected at a later point, she's remembered as somebody who would keep herself out of the limelight, who was very, very careful not to be dominant, not to be overpowering, but let others take the lead and kind of administer things as carefully as possible.
I'm talking with Professor Christoph Irmscher about his biography, Louis Agassiz, Creator of American Science. We'll talk more about the competition between Agassiz and Darwin and some of the other darker sides of Agassiz's life after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Professor Christoph Irmscher about his new biography of Louis Agassiz, one of the founding fathers of American science. Agassiz published over 400 scientific books and papers. He founded the Anderson School of Natural History on Penikese Island. He also founded the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard. Agassiz was a spectacular celebrity in his day, but he also had a dark side. Christoph Irmscher, perhaps one of the things that he is best remembered for at this point is that he was a comparative zoologist, and yet he was a staunch opponent of the Darwinian theory of evolution. As you were just talking about, there was no amount of evidence that was going to convince him of this idea.
Right. He kept saying that Darwin's argument that the geological record is imperfect and that therefore we need to substitute our thinking for what Agassiz would have considered the evidence or the facts, that this statement was ludicrous, that the fact that the evidence wasn't there meant that there wasn't any. And he kept returning to that. Agassiz and Darwin had actually started out not as collaborators, but certainly as people who would work together. Darwin's barnacle study was, in fact, inspired in some ways by Agassiz, who had publicly identified that field of natural history as something that needed to be worked on. And that's what Darwin did. And Darwin would write to Agassiz, would write for information to Agassiz, which he actually did throughout his life, because Agassiz was a fountain of knowledge, of factual knowledge. He was a great observer. He was somebody who would record details that were important to Darwin, but theoretically, they were of course at different ends of the spectrum. And Darwin realized that in order to really be successful in the United States, which was important to him, Agassiz had to be brought down, and in fact, he did. He, not personally, through Asa Gray, one of Darwin's colleagues, who was a botanist at Harvard, he was able to really bring Agassiz down on his knees, as he saw it, at least. And Agassiz was not ready for that challenge.
So what was the relationship? You at one point in the book call Asa Gray Darwin's, quote, man.
Yes.
In America. Was there a formal agreement between them, or was Asa Gray simply his champion that happened to be on this side of the ocean?
A champion. It had started out essentially as a relationship, as an epistolary relationship in letters. They would write to each other, and Gray became very important to Darwin as somebody who in botany was doing something similar, who was in fact looking at the distribution of species, especially specimens from Japan became very important for Gray as he was looking at sort of similar species in different parts of the world, which for Gray would point to a common origin in a Darwinian way. And that became very important to Darwin. So they would write about those types of things. The relationship would start out as that. In fact, when Darwin's theory was first announced to the Linnean Society, a remarkably uninterested Linnean Society, there was a letter by Darwin to Gray that was part of the package that was published in the Proceedings of the Linnean Society. So Gray was an essential part of the beginnings of Agassiz, of Darwin's work. But Gray also became the one who would confront publicly Agassiz with the error of his ways and would then report to Darwin back home on what he'd done. Gray was Darwin's informal agent in the United States. He oversaw the publication of the American edition of Origin of Species and made sure that Darwin would get paid for that. But he also became the one who, in a series of public appearances, became his unofficial spokesperson and someone who was inevitably, especially in his confrontations with Agassiz, better informed, better prepared. Agassiz was busy, you know, creating his museum and doing all these institutional things and so forth. And Gray very correctly realized that he was just not ready for the challenge. And then he would write back these sometimes very funny letters to Darwin, where he would say, Agassiz walks around Cambridge like a well-cudgeled dog, which was, you know, reporting on the result of one of his forays into evolution, public forays into evolution, where Agassiz would just look bad publicly. And he took a great deal of pleasure in that, Gray. So Gray was very different from Agassiz, which is why Agassiz underestimated him. He was a short, thin man. He was somebody. He was a Presbyterian. He was somebody who was very religious. You know, he taught Sunday school at some point. He was not a literary guy. He was not somebody the poets appreciated. Or he was just a very precise and very methodical man. No great flourishes. Which Agassiz, of course, was famous for. So you have these two kind of very different people kind of colliding, and you have the smaller one, the David of natural history, sort of winning out against the Goliath, basically, when you look at how things are unfolding.
It sounds like that could be your next book.
It's been written about.
Agassiz's views on creation, essentially, that his view was not that different, slightly different species suggested a common origin, but suggested multiple acts of creation.
Yes. Yeah.
And he uses essentially that view of multiple acts of creation in some ways to justify or to validate his racism. And he was an abolitionist, but very strongly believed that America belonged to the whites and that African people were not essentially of the same species, not of the same creation.
He was generally considered to be against slavery, even though I have to say that apart from, you know, a few scattered remarks, this is not his passion, really. One of the great puzzles about Agassiz is that racism or his racial views became so important to him. There's virtually no evidence before he comes to the United States that he has any interest in the discussion of race. And it's not like European naturalists or scientists weren't interested in it. In fact, Humboldt would be at just the other end of Agassiz's racial views and convictions and would always argue for a common humanity, as did one of his teachers, von Tiedemann in Germany. But Agassiz doesn't really show any interest in entering the discussion. Then he comes to the United States, and from the first moment that he appears, actually in his Lowell lectures, which he was invited to give in Boston, he starts talking about, racial differences and so forth. And Gray immediately writes to a friend. He says, we shouldn't talk about these things for other than scientific reasons, reasons that he doesn't understand because he's not one of us. And Gray immediately picks up on this being very problematic, that you have to be very careful with this kind of thing. Agassiz is not. He goes ahead and commissions photographs of daguerreotypes of slaves in South Carolina, which he then uses to document some kind of innate difference between black and white. Is racism is part and parcel, as you say, of a view of nature in which nothing moves. So the fear is that if you say black and white are the same, racial mixing will happen and so forth, and we have a mess going on. And it's something that some of his contemporaries realized was absurd, but not many of them. Longfellow goes to one of Agassiz's lectures on the races, human races, in the company of an Ojibwe friend, in fact, which makes it additionally problematic. And he comes home and writes in his journal, Agassiz thinks there were several Adams and Eves, which is supposed to highlight how grotesque this theory is. And Agassiz sticks to it. And one of his problems, one of the problems with his racism is that he's so public about it. While many people agreed with him, Emerson would be a particularly problematic example. Emerson says he's a man to be thankful for, and he says that after Agassiz has told him about how terrible the situation is in Brazil, where the races are freely mixing with each other, and Emerson completely agrees with him. So other people would agree with him, but for Agassiz to use his public position to underwrite these views and to promote them, which he did, creates a real problem for a biographer like me when you write about him, because you are in a situation where you have to somehow fit this into your portrait of this troubling man. And that was a real challenge, of course.
How did, you've said, okay, there's Asa Gray, who already is his opponent, so loves the fact that he's potentially hanging himself. And then you've got colleagues who actually agree with him, for whom these views are not problematic. But then there are others, as you mentioned, who don't agree with him,
right,
whether it's on evolution or on his racist views. How did they treat those? How did they reconcile their disagreement on these issues with their friendship with him?
It's one of the really difficult things for us to understand today. How could Longfellow go to dinner with him and think of him as a dear friend, whereas everything else in Longfellow's work indicates he was the first major American poet to write poems against slavery, to point out that the equality of races was so important for the future of the United States of America. Longfellow even accepted the Civil War. He was a pacifist, as probably necessary to bring about something that would that was a given for him. How they could hang out together is some of the things we can only understand if we really get a measure of how complicated the racial situation was in the 19th century, where there were so many views where you could be an abolitionist and yet a racist, where you could be a defender of slavery and yet against the kind of racial theories that Agassiz was propounding. One of my great examples is John Bachman, who was a naturalist in South Carolina, who was a great scientist. He was a minister, but he was also a scientist. He was a gardener. He knew what was happening in his garden when he looked at hybridization of plants, for instance. And even though he was a slaveholder himself, he comes out and says, Agassiz, you don't know what you're talking about, because nature doesn't work like that. So if we look at this mess of racial views, I think that's probably the best explanation we have, how people were able to compartmentalize things and yet be friends with each other, because it was so difficult to find a common denominator. One of my favorite quotes in the book comes from a columnist in Philadelphia who is so tired of all these racial discussions. And he says, it doesn't matter what you say about the black man. What's really important is that his mind is his alone and not mine, and we got absolutely nothing to say about it.
Now, his racism, Agassiz's views being on the wrong side of history when it comes to the theory of evolution, has, in some quarters at least, come to dominate his legacy. And you, in fact, give examples of, for example, the Agassiz School in Cambridge renaming itself to create distance. And you float the idea that perhaps things like Mount Agassiz and Lake Agassiz and Agassiz Street in Cambridge, are we going to see these renamed to remove Agassiz from the public, essentially? Does he deserve that?
I probably would answer the question a little differently. It's a very notion to me of excising a part of history in order for us to feel better about it, which would be the result of that, I presume, is something that seems to me to misrepresent the magnitude of the problem. You know, if we sanitize history, we don't understand what was happening at a certain point in history. Excising Agassiz from the 19th century, which would probably be what some people would like to see, in a sense prevents us from understanding how representative he is of views that were being held. It prevents us from seeing the darker side of Emerson, for example. It prevents us from seeing the complexity of the situation, and going back and, you know, washing our hands of something to me is not really the smartest move. What I would like to see is for us to remember Agassiz as part of the cultural legacy that's with us today, and to talk about it, to take this as an occasion for debate, really. My fear is if we think that we can retroactively sort of change the way things were in the 19th century, to separate the good from the bad, so to speak, that this would not be conducive to having these debates, which I think we still need to have, because traces of what Agassiz and his contemporaries represent are still with us today.
Christoph Ermscher, professor of English at Indiana University and author of Louis Agassiz, Creator of American Science. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Heather.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can find Living Lab Radio all week on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zack. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.